The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices. Conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. For this week's episode of Campus Voices, intern Caleb Baptiste and I headed over to the Special Collections Gallery on the second floor of the Morris Library, where Maureen Check, the curator of the exhibition, and Anne M. Boylan, a professor emeritus of history, took us on a tour of the current exhibition, A Terrible Beauty is Born, The Easter Rising at 100. This exhibition will be on view until June 12th of 2016.
Well, this was 2016, so this is the centenary year of the 1916 Easter Rising that happened in Dublin, Ireland. It was an unsuccessful rising, so a bunch of armed rebels tried to thwart the British forces in Dublin on Easter Monday, and not a lot of people knew about it. So it was a surprise to not only the British forces, but also really to the rest of Ireland. It was put down very quickly and very violently over Easter week until the rebels surrendered unconditionally by the end of the week because they didn't want any more civilians to get hurt. So this exhibit is commemorating that Easter week, that Easter uprising. And what it really does is contextualize before, during, and after Easter week, because you really can't understand one event in Irish history and one event so important in Irish history without understanding what happened before to precipitate it and then what happens after it because of it.
Well, the 1916 Rising, which, as Maureen pointed out, was a failed rising, is usually seen as the beginnings of modern Irish independence, Ireland as an independent country, the creation of the modern Irish state, and it looms hugely large in Irish historical memory. My own family's connection is very, very weak, but my father moved to Dublin when he was 14 years of age in 1921, and that was right at the period when the Irish government, or at least the provisional government, was negotiating its independence from Great Britain, and that led to a civil war within Ireland. My father was actually in Dublin during the civil war because those who had led the Easter Rising, at least those who were still living, who hadn't been executed, they divided over whether or not to approve a treaty with Great Britain, and that division led to the Civil War. And so my father was working in Dublin and he saw people fighting. He was a great admirer of Michael Collins, who was the leader of the pro-treaty forces, and he talked about it when I was a kid.
There's a lot of bad blood between the two sides.
Yes, although eventually one of the leaders of the anti-treaty forces, Éamon de Valera, became the president of Ireland, actually the Taoiseach, the prime minister, and then became the president. So there, for probably much of the 20th century, people in Ireland took sides over what should have been done about the treaty. Should there have been a civil war? Why was Michael Collins assassinated? Who did it? Was de Valera involved? All those kinds of questions. And so de Valera became a kind of a, because he served in various public offices for so long, he became a really central figure in people's understandings and remembering of that period in Irish history.
Well, before Maureen starts taking us around the exhibit, why don't you tell us about the faculty lecture that you're going to be giving?
Okay, I'm giving a lecture at 4:30 on March 15th in the library reading room. And I'm not a historian of Ireland. I'm trained as a historian of the United States. But when Sandra Millard asked me to do the lecture, I thought it would be an opportunity to talk about kind of the broader history of Ireland in the 20th century and the ways in which my family history intersected with that. So I'm mostly going to talk about some big themes, the memory of 1916, the Irish Constitution 1937, Irish neutrality during the war, Second World War, and then emigration, which is a huge theme in Irish history and obviously something that happened to my family since my family emigrated in 1957.
Irish immigration is certainly part of the culture all over the United States. I mean, everybody thinks of Irish-American communities in New York and Boston, but even as far west as Montana.
Oh, yeah. San Francisco, Seattle, you know, there are Irish in Cuba. There are Irish everywhere. So I think there are more Irish-American, more people of Irish descent living outside of Ireland than ever lived in Ireland.
Well, Maureen, why don't you start showing us around? Because I think some of these things, the Easter 1916 uprising has just, it hangs over Irish history still today.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it, you know, it's a pivotal point, you know, for Irish history, especially in the 20th century, as Anne said. But, you know, the events that led to it start centuries before. So starting over there in this part of the gallery.
Ireland 1900 you have up on the wall.
I have some things from the collection that show some of the previous rebellions, because 1916 was not the first, nor was it the last, really. And the men and women who participated in 1916 drew on this tradition, you know, from earlier rebellions, from 1798 especially, 1803, 1867. You know, all of these were failed rebellions, or 1848, sorry about that. None of these were successful, but, you know, these are, you know, it's a patriot culture on which they drew, and one that supported their notions of physical force, especially, rather than diplomacy, because they saw that continuing to fail as home rule, which is would have given Ireland measure of independence to deal with their own domestic affairs and their own parliament, kept failing. So the 1801 Acts of Union incorporated Ireland into Great Britain and dissolved their parliament. And so over the 19th century, different movements to abolish that, the Acts of Union, were led by peaceful and unpeaceful means. Daniel O'Connell, who was known as the Liberator, he did a lot for Catholic emancipation over the 19th century. There were Catholic penal laws that were in place for centuries, which disenfranchised and prevented Catholic people from owning property, participating in government, things like that, holding different kinds of jobs. And he did a lot to abolish those. And so he led, you know, more peaceful means of trying to campaign for home rule, but those were also unsuccessful. Charles Stuart Parnell was another major figure in the 19th century who, you know, was trying to advocate for parliamentary measures to make things, you know, more equitable in Ireland. And
but Parnell was a Protestant. I thought part of this had to do with, you know, if you were Protestant, you were part of the occupiers.
That's a really that's an oversimplification. The, you know, there's no one group that you can see. It's not necessarily Protestants versus Catholics and British versus Irish. It's a lot more complex than that. Some of the, you know, first people to agitate for a measure of independence in Ireland were Protestants.
Like one of the great heroes in Ireland for whom there are many, many statues is Wolfe Tone, who helped to lead the 1798 rebellion, influenced and maybe inspired by the French Revolution. And he was a Protestant. Parnell was a Protestant. So they're still very much revered in Ireland, statues, streets named after them, and so on. The creation of a kind of a more Catholic Ireland is really a product, I would argue, of the 1916 events and then the 1922 treaty and the particular 1937 Constitution, which for the first time enshrined the Catholic Church as having a special place in the governing of Ireland. And in recent years, people who would like to revise that constitution have worked very hard to remove some of those elements from it, particularly women's rights activists, but also people who would like to have a much more tolerant and perhaps more secular Irish government. Even today, you could read an article in the paper probably a month ago about the basic requirement of many schools in Ireland that children who attend those schools must show a certificate of baptism, which means that if you're Jewish, if you're Hindu, if you're a non-believer, you may have a great deal of difficulty getting your children into schools. So that remains an issue in Ireland as of 2016.
What's this broadside? What are these broadsides you have up here?
So one collection that we have here is of publications and prints and things related to the Kula Press, and that was a press that was run by the Yeats sisters, Lily and Lolly, as they were called. And the press in Ireland was very important to, you know, spread not only the cultural nationalism that was building over the 19th century in terms of ideas and beliefs and even news, so newspapers, literary journals. But it also, like Kula, was a cottage industry. So it employed Irish girls. This was, you know, run by women, and it tried to employ Irish women using Irish material. So a big selling point for a lot of goods and things like that in the 19th century, in advertisements and things like that, were to buy Irish. And this is one example. And so W.B. Yeats, he contributed quite a bit to a broadside. So did his brother Jack B. Yeats, who was also an artist. And we have some excellent examples of a broadside. A broadside published new and traditional songs and ballads. Song being a very important part of also spreading Irish culture. And tradition, you know, comes from an oral history tradition. As people emigrated, you know, Irish song was an important way to hold on to your stories and be able to spread those stories. An important part of also preserving Irish language, which is another significant portion of the cultural nationalist movement in the 19th century with the Gaelic League.
Is Gaelic still taught in the schools?
Yes, they don't call it Gaelic, though. They call it Irish. So if you're in Ireland, you have to say Irish Gaelic or Scots Gaelic or something along those lines so people understand what you're talking about. But when they teach it in the schools, they teach Irish, yeah. There's been a move in recent years to cut back on the requirement that certain subjects be taught in Irish, but was, as Maureen is pointing out, a very important part of the cultural nationalism that preceded the movement for independence and was part of a larger sense that Ireland needed its identification that was separate from that of England and language, song, music, poetry, folk tales would all be part of that. So not only Yeats, but also Lady Gregory, who was one of his associates and helped create the Abbey Theatre, they were really, really devoted to the idea that Irish folk tales and folklore, as well as the Irish language, ought to be revived, spread, taught, recited, and so on.
Another important point is that they were both Protestant. So there's no easy way to divide pride in being Irish with religion. So that's, as I said before, a major oversimplification of the issue. You know, you'd be surprised to know that many of the people who were very proud of their heritage and started these movements were, you know, landed Protestant people. Maud Gunn, for example, you know, she was English-born and Protestant. She later converted to Catholicism, but, you know, there's no easy way to define that. You know, there's no line you can draw.
So what do we have that's more contemporary with the 1916 Rising?
Well, the material I have here is more directly about the Rising or by people who were involved in it. It's interesting to note that many of the leaders of the Rising were educators and poets. Many of them were. Patrick Pearse, he was an educator, also a poet. You know, a lot of it really comes through in how much he wrote about the Rising. So, you know, through his writings, both before to justify what they were doing, you know, solidified his place as, you know, kind of the icon of the Rising. So we have in here poems about the Rising. There were a lot of poems. Dora Shorter.
I see. 16 Dead Men. Mm-hmm. And other poems.
Yes, it said she died of heartbreak over Ireland. She was married to publisher and journalist Clement King Shorter, and he actually published the first edition of Yeats's Easter 1916, of which we have one of only 25 existing copies. So we hold that here at the University of Delaware, which is fantastic. And she died, I think, in 1922, and some of her friends, you know, wrote a nice little memorial booklet for her, including Catherine Tynan. And he published that and distributed that among her friends. We also have a copy of that here at the university. So a lot of people, you know, in order to express, people had so many mixed feelings about this. This wasn't necessarily, you know, people were very supportive of this when it happened. You know, not, like I said, not a lot of people knew it was even going to happen. And the reaction to it initially wasn't very supportive. It demolished Dublin all across the city. A lot of people died and were injured. And not a lot of people really supported the physical force movement. Not a lot of people really wanted to see this happen through so much violence. For example, you know, Yeats's Easter 1916 is really thought of as this, you know, Republican poem, which it's really not. It expresses a lot of anxiety about what these men and women did. And, you know, it's a lamentation. It eulogizes them. You know, it respects their dream, but not necessarily the way that they did it.
Anne, you said you specialize history in the United States. And as Maureen's been talking, I've been thinking it's not a one-to-one mapping, but I hear in some of the ambivalence that Maureen's been talking about, some things that echo for me what happened for some families in 1860, you know, particularly in this part of the United States. I mean, mm-hmm. Which side were you going to be on?
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting connection to make. I would argue that, and I think Maureen certainly has made this point in the materials that are accompanying the exhibit, that there's a difference there in that the Easter Rising became the iconic moment that it did because of the decisions of the British government. Mm-hmm. That is, they decided to execute 14 of the leaders of the Rising at Kilmainham Jail. They did it in the space of about a week. One of them, James Connolly, was a labor leader and a socialist, had been wounded in the Easter Rising, and he was carried from his hospital bed, strapped to a chair, and shot dead in the yard at Kilmainham Jail. And the brutality of the British government's response to what seemed like a kind of a quixotic effort by a few Irish nationalists is really what rallied the Irish population. Now, you could make a similar sort of argument, perhaps, about the outbreak of the American Civil War in 1861. That is, that when the attempted secession of South Carolina led the South Carolina government, that is the government of what they began to call the Confederacy, to shoot at and try and attack mm-hmm. a federal fort in Charleston Harbor, that galvanized a lot of the population of the Union to try to oppose this seemingly quixotic effort to create a Confederacy of states dedicated to slavery. So there are some parallels there, but there's a very small group of people who lead this rising, and it's a failed effort, Maureen was pointing that out, but it becomes a galvanizing force because of how the British government responded. Yeah, months and months of grassroots organizing, getting people who had been mostly, I would say, indifferent to what had happened on Easter Monday, to become infuriated and to decide that the British government's actions made absolutely no sense at a time when a fairly large number, thousands of Irish young men were fighting in the British Army on the British side in the First World War. So it's the aftermath that really creates this huge uprising of nationalist sentiment that then leads to elections in which a party that supports separation of Ireland, independence of Ireland, wins more and more seats in an Irish parliament. And that eventually leads to the 1922 treaty with Great Britain that established a very, very, very provisional, very, very constrained independence for Ireland, which eventually was turned into a real independence, but only for 26 of the 32 counties of Ireland. The treaty created a partition which led to 6 of the 9 counties of Ulster being separated from the rest of Ireland and maintained as part of the United Kingdom. And that, of course, remains an issue up to this very day.
Kayla, the intern, you might need to look at these. So these are what letters look yes. like before email. whose letters are these?
So these are some letters out of our Shipley Bringhurst Hargreaves family papers. People might know that, you know, the family home was Rockwood Mansion, where one, you know, generation of the Bringhursts had lived. So these are some letters from Bessie, Elizabeth Bringhurst Galt Smith, known as Bessie, to her mother. She married this man whose ancestral home he purchased in County Antrim in the north, Kilwater Castle. So she was there during the rising, and several of her servants had friends and family in Dublin at the time, and they weren't getting a lot of news about what had actually happened and by whom and who was okay and who was not. So she's writing to her mother about a week or so after it actually happened and letting her know the concern of her servants and then the news as they receive it. They were certainly, Bessie and her family there at Kilwater were Ulster Unionists, so they were on the other side, and they did not want to see an independent Ireland from Great Britain. So it provides another, the other side of the story and how some other people felt about it. And she, you know, like other people in the immediate aftermath of the rising, didn't like what they were doing because it was very violent. It hurt and killed a lot of people. And it, like I said, destroyed a large part of Dublin. So yeah, these are great letters.
What else would you like to show us?
Well, I guess some of the things that incorporate, you know, the aftermath later into the 20th century, you know, the rising continued to be an issue, you know, culturally and politically. So one example is Sean O'Casey's Plough in the Stars. He wrote that for the Abbey Theatre, so it debuted in 1926, so 10 years after the rising, and it takes place during the rising, and it was critical of what the leaders did and how they did it. So again, you know, you have this kind of dissident voice in here, and people were not happy. They thought he was, you know, kind of betraying the people who fought and died during the rising, and there was a staged protest during one of the performances, and many of the widows and bereaved women from the rising came and tried to protest his play. And W.B. Yeats got up and said, you know, this is not what modern Irish theater is about. You know, you kind of disgraced yourselves again, this audience. And it harkens back to another time when he did that in 1907 for J.M. Singh's Playboy of the Western World. So the theater was very important in terms of trying to get across, you know, initially ideas of nationalism. So the Abbey Theater became the Irish National Theater. But they started staging more modern Irish drama, that didn't necessarily mean you couldn't critique, you know, what was going on in Ireland or Irish history, but some Irish audiences seem to think that. So that's one example of some things that happened in Ireland, you know, in the immediate aftermath of the rising, where if you tried to disagree with what happened, you know, people protested your artwork. So I do have something, you know, some really great things here from the War of Independence. I have some service medals that are on loan from Bernard McKenna, his daughter Aidan. He's a professor in the English department. So these are some service medals. One is a service medal from 1917, 1921, and the other is the Survivor's Medal. So the truce was called in 1921 for the War of Independence, and then the service medal is 1971, so for the 50th anniversary. So those are some nice medals there. I also have some material on loan from Jim Burns from the English department. His great-grandfather had purchased a Republic of Ireland certificate bond to help support the Republic. So Eamon de Valera was over in the United States in about 1919, 1920, trying to get support from the United States for the Republic, but he was also trying to raise money. So what this American Commission on Irish Independence did was that they, you know, tried to raise a lot of money, and they did. They raised millions of dollars. They were also important in trying to get some of the, you know, Irish delegates into the Paris peace talks. They didn't really succeed doing that, but they certainly succeeded in raising a lot of money and, you know, really trying to tap into this large Irish diaspora in the United States at the time.
Do you know how did the Irish perceive their participation in World War I? Was it?
Well, in the United States, American participation in the First World War was fairly divisive. There were Irish Americans who, particularly after Easter 1916, thought the United States should stay out of the war. Of course, the United States was only involved in the war for a very short period of time, starting in 1917. Once the American involvement began, many Irish Americans felt that there should be no support among Irish Americans for the war because their compatriots back in Ireland were fighting for their independence against Great Britain, and they saw that as analogous to a fight for independence against Britain in 1776. On the other hand, plenty of Irish Americans served in the First World War. And so you have the same kind of situation in Ireland in 1914, 15, 16, 17, 18. Numbers of Irish men who were serving in the British Army to fight against Germany and to win the First World War. They were doing so as volunteers. The British floated the idea in 1918 of drafting Irish men to serve in the war. That was not popular, as you can well imagine. So like so many of these things, there's no one position. There are divisions, and the divisions reflect history and culture and religion and attitudes toward nationalism and everything else. But as Maureen pointed out, Eamon de Valera spent about, he actually escaped from prison in Britain, and he spent over a year in the United States making these trips all around. And that was one of the things that probably made his political career. He was the only surviving battalion leader of the 1916 Rising. And as the only surviving one, once Michael Collins was killed, you know, he acquired a huge reputation on both sides of the ocean, and he made an effort to get Irish involvement or Irish representation at the Paris peace talks in Versailles to end the First World War. So he was somebody who made the most of his connections to the United States and these divisions among Irish Americans and Irish in Ireland over Britain's role.
Well, just standing in the gallery here on the second floor of the library, I just get the sense that this event that happened over a very short period of time still hangs over the history in Ireland, England, and every place that the Irish have emigrated to.
Well, if anybody who's listening goes to visit Ireland this year in 2016, believe me, they will see many, many commemorations. New museums, there's a brand new museum at the old Collins Barracks in Dublin. Kilmainham Jail, where the leaders were executed, has undergone a fairly big renovation with a very, very good museum exhibit. And I was telling Maureen, I was there in December, and it's become one of the most popular museum tours in Dublin, second only to the Guinness Brewery, I'm not sure. But Guinness remains the number one tourist attraction in Dublin.
Maureen, any closing comments?
Well, I'd certainly like people to come in and see the exhibit. You know, one of the great things about our special collections here at Delaware is really the breadth that we have, and that was what I was trying to go for in this exhibit. I was telling Anne, and I'll tell anybody, that I could have done an exhibit on any one of these themes, an entire exhibit, because they're so complex and multi-layered and nuanced. There's no, you know, I think as we pointed to earlier, there's no one way to see Irish history. You can view it through many lenses and find interesting stories and interesting people. You know, it's been very, you know, some of these events are very violent, but there's also a lot of beauty and culture and pride in Ireland and Irish history, and with the cultural revival of the 19th century and some of that material I tried to bring out here in terms of sports, language, theater, literature, the press and art and music. There's, you know, this other side to it that I wanted people to see too. The theater, you know, is a very important part of Ireland and Irish history, not only for literature, but also for politics. And it's something that's very near and dear to my heart. And I devoted an entire case to the Gaelic Athletic Association. I love hurling. Mm-hmm. I think it's fantastic. Also, very political, very politicized sport, Gaelic football, women's hurling called camogie. So that's one thing that I really love about, you know, the Gaelic revival. But that in itself was also a very political movement. It was very anti-English when it was first established.
This exhibit is open for the spring 2016 semester, and it's going to be here until?
June 12th.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.